Hello.
Hello. Is that your bad foreign accent to fit in with the plot?
No. I don't want to necessarily do anything as offensive as the Russian accents in this movie, which are interesting because we have a whole slew of people from other parts of Europe. Yeah, the defense minister guy, French, General Ormov, German.
You know, it was the 90s. You were allowed to be stereotypically Russian without really having to worry too much about it.
Fomka, not Russian either.
Is that the appropriate pronunciation of her name?
I believe it's Fomka, but I can't remember if it's Janssen or Jensen. Janssen, I think. I don't know. Sorry,
Fomka. It's not Famke Janssen.
I don't think it's Famke.
Famke?
No, I don't think it's Famke. I don't think it rhymes with Outuki.
We could just call her Phoenix, which is, you know, Awatuki is within Phoenix.
She was on Star Trek. Did you know that?
I don't know. What would she do in the Star Trek?
She played an alien concubine creature that was attracted to whoever opened the container she was in, and she was attracted to Captain Jean-Luc Picard, but she was betrothed to someone else. And it was a really dumb episode.
Opened her container? What is she, like leftover mashed potatoes in the fridge or something?
It's more complicatedly stupid than that. It was like some form of political appeasement or whatever, and it was a tradition, so they couldn't interfere or whatever, but they were just going to carry this person off to servitude.
She's got some freckles around her hair that look alien.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Well, I'm sorry, Dan. It's not my fault. Yeah. I didn't do it.
She's good at stuff.
Yeah,
although she only
learned
one Russian curse word for this movie.
Mm. There was a guy who was tasked with being the dialogue and linguistics coach. So,
I think everybody has those.
Yeah, but
Jennifer Lawrence talked about how much work she put into her Russian accent for Red Sparrow.
How was that? I didn't see it.
I saw it in pieces, like the first half, and then a couple weeks later I saw the second half. And I'm not sure it would feel less disjointed if I had seen it in one sitting, but you know, it's fine. It's not. It's bleak, you know, Russian.
That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it bleak in Russian?
I don't know. It's about female spies who seduce and kill people.
Okay. Well, that's nice. Speaking of spies who seduce and kill people, we are doing 007, GoldenEye. Which you may have inferred from things we were saying and words we were using and actors we were talking about. But if that was unclear, let us welcome you into the circle of knowledge that that includes GoldenEye,
the 1995 film.
Yeah,
it was a good movie.
The one word, GoldenEye, no space.
Camel case.
Yep, it's the movie that revived the Bond franchise after Timothy Dalton's disastrous and unappealing two movies killed it. There was going to be a third Timothy Dalton movie, but there were complications with MGM, United Artists, and Eon Productions with Albert Broccoli, the longtime producer of all of these, and the daughter, Barbara Broccoli. Like trying to figure out how to navigate those issues. So they got this finally back into production. They lost Timothy Dalton and they got back Pierce Brosnan, who was their original choice before Timothy Dalton in the 80s. But he,
that's so.
Yeah, but he was on Remington Steel, so he couldn't get out of that contract. The lucrative Remington Steel contract. Remember the show?
No, I don't remember the show. Isn't that a brand of men's razor, electric razor?
Well, Remington also made typewriters, which was how she came up with the name. And it was a lady protagonist who was dealing with the chauvinism and misogyny of the era, and so she basically hired out Pierce Brosnan to actually be the face of the operation while she was the brains, because people wouldn't treat her correctly. It's an interesting program.
That's the premise of Remington Steele?
I believe so. It's been many years since I've seen it, but I believe that is the general gist.
I never
and
saw it.
And there's your requisite will they, won't they tension.
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think if there are any complaints I have about this movie, it's that one little particular bit where they do the will they part, because it's unnecessary and it's silly. There are a lot of Bond tropes and things in this movie that make it a Bond film, as required, I think, by, I don't know, government, federal, state, global law.
Mm-hmm. Licensed and bonded.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You have to have your martini shaken, not stirred. You have to have your, you know, some quippy lines.
Your delivery of Bond, James Bond, that line. Mm-hmm. You gotta do it.
It's all in there. But this movie takes things quite a bit more seriously than some of the other Bond movies. In particular, all of the other Bond movies that include Pierce Brosnan after this, which turned sort of into a bit of a Batman Returns kind of like, well, wait, which one? Which of the terrible ones with the Batman nipples? They just start to go off the rails, basically.
Batman Forever.
Forever, there you go.
That's the first Joel Schumacher one. The suit with the nipples is introduced at the end of the movie because they're the prototype suits that they haven't tested yet.
Right.
And then Batman and Robin is, I believe, the universally agreed upon a bad one, where there's no fans of that who will stand up and say, you know, there's kind of some funny stuff. Not for that one. But I do kind of have a fondness for Batman Forever. It's silly and it knows what it is. Like that, I also have a certain fondness for the sequel to this, Tomorrow Never Dies, even though that one is a little Looney Tunes as well, but not to the degree that we wind up getting to in the last two Pierce Brosnan films, where you're just like, what was happening in the writing room for this? Like, how did any of this get put onto a page with other words and then strung together into something that was filmed? For these first two, at least, I feel like there is there's plenty to appreciate, even with some things to not enjoy completely.
You said you have a fondness for Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yes.
Which one is that? That's the one media conglomerate guy who's gonna destroy the world.
Yeah, because as we know, people who are insanely rich and powerful and control the media don't in any way shape the political narrative that goes on in the world.
Especially if they have a stealth boat that has a like buzzsaw thing on it.
Yeah, if Rupert Murdoch had a stealth boat, this would be so much easier. We could just be like, let's go get the stealth boat, guys. But he doesn't.
Yeah, I didn't realize that GoldenEye was apparently not based on any previous Bond material, books or otherwise. I saw that on the Wikipedia there.
Yeah, and most of these movies have been loose adaptations of the books anyways, and some of them adapted multiple times, but it's fine. I don't need it to be based on the books.
No, I was going to say the plot of this movie makes a whole lot more sense than a lot of the other ones, because it sort of just kind of turns into a little bit of a you know, post-Soviet kind of spy movie, whether it's Bond or not. And I think they did a good job of like blending the Bondness with the general European spyness of it all.
Yeah, well, and I feel like it's necessary to not base it on one of the James Bond books, because you need to modernize the world that James Bond is operating in, because the world in which those books were written is not relevant, really, even in the time frame of 1995 or 94 when this is written. So,
Director Mr. Martin Campbell apparently also directed the first Daniel Craig Casino Royale, which is that's an adaptation of one of the books, right? Like the original Casino Royale was very, very old, but that's still one of the books, isn't it?
Yes, but yeah. It's like I said, the varying degrees to which they adapt these things. Because, you know, that one you can be like, yeah, terrorist, whatever. But it's interesting here because we're dealing with the dynamic of global politics changing since the last James Bond movie was before the Berlin Wall came down. What was that? License to Kill or Living Daylights? I can't remember which one comes first.
I don't know any of those names.
They're not good. They're really not good. But I don't revisit them often, and I don't recommend them to people. I know that there are people who have a certain fondness for them, but
For all the old ones?
No, well, those two specifically, because those are the only two Timothy Dalton ones.
People have a specific fondness for Timothy Dalton.
There are a handful. There are dozens of people.
There are dozens of them.
Yeah. But, you know, on the plus side, if Timothy Dalton hadn't been James Bond, he wouldn't have been in Hot Fuzz, because yeah. Edgar Wright was casting James Bond's as people in his movies.
I like him in Hot Fuzz.
Mm-hmm.
I could take him or leave him as a Bond.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Pierce Brosnan got the short end of the stick when he got his Edgar Wright assignment.
What was his?
The one with the aliens and the blue goop in the end of the world.
Oh, right. Yes. That wasn't that bad. He had a good role there, I think.
I didn't care for that one that much.
Yeah, well, that's...
Yeah, but this movie, you know, it's written with a certain... global framing of like, well, how do we set up James Bond to operate in this world?
And they do a whole lot more setup for the world and the character within that world than probably all the other movies do, don't they?
Well, I think this is one of the reasons why I think this particular movie holds up pretty okay, because a lot of times if you're watching a movie and you don't understand the politics of the time, it may be lost, like what the tensions are between certain nation states and stuff. It's very clear here because they're spelling it out on screen. This is an edutainment movie. There is one
scene where they're looking at the real time satellite of Severnaya, where they're having their gigantic exposition conversation within three characters who kind of all are talking exactly the same way, because you just need to get a bunch of stuff out of the table. That's a little over the top, but they do make it pretty clear, you know, who had allegiances to whom. Why? Who? Some people betrayed other people. What their motivations were, and it's understandable. It's straightforward. It's partially based in reality, and it sets everything up to feel more realistic. And I think it's uncommon for these, because like, while I love a lot of the Daniel Craig James Bond stuff, it really is just a lot of running in car chases and punching people. Like, you don't really get into the you know, the national foreign politics of the whole thing.
Yeah, because in those ones, it's more about the action than the I don't know, the spycraft of it, I guess.
Yeah, they did lean into James Bond being the sort of dumb, brutal guy who punches people really hard and runs real fast. They did that intentionally with Daniel Craig, but He kept some of his, like, you know, womanizing swarthiness or whatever, but he doesn't have it on the scale of these previous movies, where there is like actual like foreign policy spycraft being executed theoretically in some of these.
Yeah, and in those, it's also a lot about they start to center on the personal backstory of James Bond in a unpleasant way. This one invents like a little prologue here at the beginning of the movie, where we see a mission that went wrong and a coworker. And I can appreciate that, because it's self-contained within the film. It's not like his dad or like a long lost something or other relative or anything. Right. Like this is all very tight, like in terms of the writing of it.
Yeah, in any of the other previous movies where you meet another one of the 00s, it's for like 3 seconds where he's like, oh, hello, nice to see you there. And they like hand him something and then they walk off and you never see them ever again.
Yeah, and well, I mean, that's pretty normal because this is a movie about 007, not a movie about 006. But why was 006 afraid of 007?
Oh, boy. Because 007, 008, 009?
Yes. That works flawlessly.
God, this is stupid.
Well, but I like the introduction of this. We get the usual cold open of a James Bond film where it's like, here's a mission that someone's on. Here's a thing that's happening. Here's a dramatic moment before the titles.
They do a great job of like, you know it's Pierce Brosnan. You saw the trailers. You showed up to the movie. But they do a great job of kind of like hiding his face and not revealing him immediately because this is his debut as James Bond, and he's running about doing spy type things and skydiving off of dams and things. But they do a good job of dramatically revealing him. Although it's a little silly the way he's revealed hanging upside down through a vent in a bathroom or something.
I don't like that because it also like he's obviously been hanging upside down for a few minutes doing this for a couple takes because it seems like the blood has all rushed to his head and he just like looks physically like puffy and in pain. And he's supposed to be delivering this line of dialogue before he punches out someone. And the guy that he's delivering this dialogue to has to just sit there dumbly, not reacting at all. So it kind of is I don't like that, but it is, you know, kind of your requisite quip before the punch.
Something about Pierce Brosnan in this movie in general, like he kind of looks like a cooked steak a lot of the time. Like I think he has a lot of blood in his face a lot.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think part of it's just the 90s-ness and the Britishness. Well, he's not British, but like, you know, just
Irish.
His general demeanor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, but I like Pierce Brosnan. He's very charismatic. I think that he can be serious when he needs to be serious, and I think he can play along with all the goofy stuff when there's goofy stuff.
Mm-hmm. I like him a lot, too. And again, I think as we talked about in one of our single-digit episodes with Matt Alexander, that Pierce Brosnan is kind of like our generation Bond because we grew up in this era, but also just like him better than the other ones.
Yeah, well, because not all of them pull off the seriousness and the goofiness all the time. Because
it's great because his face too, like he has that like sort of scowl face, and the difference between his serious face and his like jokey face is like 5 degrees difference. Like it's almost the same face.
Yeah, but you know, it's all about subtlety. This is a movie about subtlety.
One thing that's not subtle about Pierce Brosnan, which sort of lends to his masculine James Bond British old school character, is his just massive plume of chest hair.
Yeah, well, you know, what are you gonna do? They even poke fun of that in Austin Powers, but
is that where the reference in Austin Powers came from?
No, well, I believe it was to Sean Connery, but also just this general thing. But
good thing none of those Batman suits had chest hair, just nipples.
That would have been a very strange design, just like a deep plunging V in the front. Where would you put the Bat logo? That's what I want to know.
No, it would just be like a hard plastic embossed chest hair on the front.
How can you hard emboss chest hair, Dan?
I can find a way.
Okay. Well,
then you just sort of like shave a Batman logo in it.
Oh, you do it like a like little pieces of carpet, like a yellow.
Oh, dear.
This starts with the very difficult to execute stunts. We get into this bathroom. We are introduced to Pierce Brosnan. We are introduced to shadowy figure who turns out to be Sean Bean. This is, I believe, the start of Sean Bean's long career of being somebody who dies in a movie. but he's you know, very believable as another British agent, and they go on their mission to blow up this thingy to do the whatever. And they run into General Orimov, and there's a standoff, and we get something that repeats over and over again, where General Orimov has a gun to 006's head, and he's going to kill him. But he's not gonna, because it's a setup, but we don't know that until later. He threatens to kill him unless James Bond surrenders. And so James doesn't, because, you know, he's not supposed to. And then he blows the crap out of everything.
There's a good bit of comedy, too, where he's slowly making his way across the room, hiding behind that little cart full of barrels, and just squeaking wheel, just creeping across until he runs into the conveyor belt.
Yeah, I also like when the soldiers are told not to shoot at the explosive barrels, because apparently we're in a Doom level or something, and everything's just explosive barrels. But
well, it's a chemical weapons plant, so you got to have a lot of barrels of explosive material laying around.
Yeah,
very shiny kegs.
So one of the not so bright guys shoots at one of the shiny kegs, and Orimov just turns right around and kills that guy, which is just an interesting little affectation, because it lets you know that he's taking the actual flammableness of the materials seriously.
Orimov might be the most slapsticky character in this movie, just based on some of the goofiness in his face and stuff.
Oh, he falls apart, like, completely by the middle of the movie.
Well, in terms of just general believability? Or
Yeah, because he just gets more disheveled, and
he's just sweaty, tugging on his collar, like, ugh.
You know, sipping from his flask. But James Bond flips a little thingy that causes all the barrels to fall out, which that must have been a mess on set to deal with. But he gets out of there and chases a plane with a motorcycle, and there's a cool stunt maneuver of someone riding off the edge of this thing on a motorcycle and then catching up to the plane.
It's pretty good stunt. In terms of opening Bond scenes where something dramatic happens before the credits, I always liked this one. It was a mission. It was still short and kind of sweet and dramatic. And how cool was that he rode the motorcycle off the cliff and just sort of skydived after the plane, and then hopped in, and then, you know.
Yeah. And that's like the bungee jumpy part earlier. I think apparently they like set a record or something for it being like the highest altitude bungee jump or something like that for that stunt guy who did it. But kudos to them. They did some interesting stunts. Like, nowadays you'd be like, I'm not going to kill anybody, so we're going to do that with computers. But fortunately these people all survived these daring dues.
One of the things about this movie, and that scene in particular, the jump there sort of sets it off, is they were really big on Foley and sound design in the 90s, weren't they? Because like, every footstep is incredibly loud. There's not a ton of score in some of these places. And like, when he's jumping and doing the skydive, like, or the bungee jump, it gets real quiet, and like, the motion is in slow motion, but you still see, you hear like the wind going by, and you hear the clinking of the little buckles attached to his feet and stuff. And it's all very, very loud, intricate, like, intimate Foley work.
Yeah. Although there's some that I don't love, when he gets to the plane and it starts making the like Warner Brothers cartoon plane crashing sound. Yeah.
It's basically like a James Bond ASMR movie, though.
I don't love that one sound thing. But then he pulls up just in the nick of time, because he's just been helplessly using the whatever it is, the stick. Is that what you call it? This is a flight term, but
the flight stick.
Yeah, there's zero resistance on this when he's. When he's being filmed doing this, so he's obviously just like flopping his hand around.
He's jiggling it with the resistance.
Yeah,
he's feeling resistance.
He's jiggling his stick, but he pulls up. The miniature of the facility blows up, and we cut to the title sequence, which
mission
is
accomplished.
The first time I believe that they used computer graphics for a Bond title sequence, if I'm not mistaken. I think they use computer-assisted stuff in previous title sequences in the 80s, but I think this is the first one at least with digital compositing.
Oh yeah, because this is when you get your classic Bond intro, especially that you've come to expect now, where you've got your very James Bondy song, you've got your silhouettes of guns and women and stuff. Oh God, what did I say? Alexa, stop.
It's okay. I said seriousness earlier, and it set off something. I don't always love the naked ladies in these things. It's a little goofy. But you get all the themes about the Soviet Union collapsing, the Cold War being over.
All the sickles and hammers and things.
Yeah, with naked ladies crawling all over them. And then you get all the stuff with the guns and the Janus thing. You get like the double-headed lady who has a gun come out of her mouth. So it really sets you up. And you get the wonderful performance of Tina Turner singing a song that's by Bono and The Edge, which I can't think of a more 90s combination of things to put together than that, but there you go.
Bono, The Edge, and Tina Turner.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating combination. Now, apparently, the producers did not have access to what they were doing for this opening thing when the score was happening, so there's none of this is like used in the score later, like in other Bond movies, where it's like there's references, the little layup motif to what's in the opening titles. Mm. It's completely separate from everything else, which is maybe why this is good and the score is bad. But
the score is very bad.
The score is very bad. And we are immediately cut to it being probably the worst part of the score, which is the little car chase through the mountains.
It may as well be from an Austin Powers score.
It is like it's beneath Beverly Hills Cop. Like it's not even like cute and campy. It like is just this weird synthy, like mashing atonal blobby thing that I despise.
Like a 15-year-old with a Casio keyboard thought they wanted to do something like Beverly Hills Cop, and that's what they came up with.
Yeah, and so this is Eric Serra as the composer for this film. This is the only James Bond movie that he ruined. Now, it's not so horrible all of the time, but most of the time you find yourself wondering, hey, there's not really any music in this part. And that's because there isn't. Eric Serra collaborated a lot with Luc Besson and, you know, did like Fifth Element and stuff. So there's a part in here where I believe it's when they're in like the decommissioned statue graveyard, whatever, where you get some of the weird like Fifth Element alien noises or whatever in the score, and it's just like, this is odd, ill-fitting thing for James Bond. But
I do almost like how there is a lot of parts of the movie that don't have score, because it does kind of, at least for me, it brings me back to some of the older films, because, you know, films in the 70s definitely had much less score and a lot more silence, and they were okay with that, which is why it's kind of hard nowadays for modern audiences to watch some of those older movies, because it just like lulls you to sleep with just soundscapes of, I don't know, wind and footsteps on gravel and stuff.
Well, I think that in the 70s you also had a slower pace of editing generally. Mm-hmm.
It's still got a reasonably slow pace. I mean, it's starting to pick up because they can edit with computers now, but
I believe this was still cut on film, according to the credits.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
It looks very filmy.
Yes. Well, but they have beautiful anamorphic lenses in this film.
It is anamorphic, and that's, I think, another thing that sort of lends it to being sort of an older feel. But I was at some point going to ask you about the cinematography. I don't know if you want to get into that now.
Sure, why not? We're only talking about a car chase. So what is it you want to mention about the cinematography?
I don't know. It feels very much of an era. Like, it feels like, in the same way that sort of the Beverly Hills Cop stuff, mostly Beverly Hills Cop 2, kind of felt like peak 80s era cinematography, this kind of feels like right around when like the 90s action stuff kind of hit its stride. Like, it has kind of, a lot of it has a little bit of like a dim, desaturated kind of brown look to it. I know a lot of that is probably intentionally because of the you know, the context of the film itself, but I like the way this looks. It really looks of a time to me. It does not have a bright, shiny, glossy, saturated look most of the time.
No, there's one exception when they go to Havana and they have their like moment by the water, and she's like walking by the water away from the villa that yeah. they're in. And there's,
you mean when it turns into a Michelob Light commercial for a couple minutes?
Yeah, yeah. That one's a little, that part's a little strange, but
that whole scene should, on like everything about him sulking on the beach and then them like hooking up, that should be cut out, because like they're in Havana to do a job and then she's suddenly walking on the beach in a bikini and a sarong or something. It's like, no, don't do this here.
Yeah, there is also a very unfortunate shot where you're examining the connection point of legs to the lower portion of someone, which is not obscured at all by what she's wearing. So that's unfortunate. yeah, it's a crotch
like
shot.
Missed,
it's a crotch
shot. Whatever you're yeah. referring to, but I believe it.
Yeah. But they, back to the beginning of this film. But wait, before we do that, this cinematographer is Phil Mayo, or Mayo? I don't know. He's from England, but I don't know how to say it because there's a weird accent over the E in the middle. So maybe it's Mijo, something? I don't know. But Phil, we'll just call him Phil, he is a pretty decent cinematographer. And as you noted, it's a style that is very...
Oh, wow. He came back for Casino Royale, too.
Yeah, he collaborates frequently with Martin Campbell, as he did for No Escape, apparently, The Saint, Mask of Zorro, Entrapment.
You got to watch The Saint one of these days.
I haven't seen The Saint. I've seen The Mask of Zorro and Entrapment. There's Bicentennial Man. He did Bedazzled for Harold Ramis, which is what? He did The Core again. What? I would say the Casino Royale, GoldenEye are probably the ones that I would highlight in here as notable achievements. But things kind of fell off a little in the late 2000s, because then he did Beverly Hills Chihuahua with Rajna Gosnell, who was the he would go on to be the director for the two Smurfs movies. So he was also the cinematographer on the Smurfs and the Smurfs 2. That included me. And then he did the SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water. So what a career.
hell of a career. He's still working at 78, yeah. Too. That's impressive.
Yeah, yeah. I think that he did a fantastic job in GoldenEye. I love the anamorphic lenses that he uses. Everything has a... it is anamorphic, but it still has a clarity to it, which is hard to do sometimes. If you watch a lot of stuff from nowadays that uses like really super old anamorphic lenses from the 70s that are all beat to crap, then you get a lot of not as nice, not as sharp, not as clear stuff yeah. as what
and
you
they,
get here.
They don't show off doing a lot of like long lens, giant bokeh right behind people's heads, anamorphic stuff. There was, honestly, I wasn't even consciously aware of the anamorphicness until I think there's a shot outside Severnaya where there's a rack focus from the like the satellite to somebody's face, and just the way it rack focused, I went, oh, this must be anamorphic. And then I looked it up and I was like, yeah, look at that, huh? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well. It's pretty easy to tell whenever anybody rack focuses an anamorphic, because it's like, whoa, the aspect ratio
stretches.
On the background changes.
Uh-huh.
But like, there's also
why
some
they
nice
don't do it very often.
Yeah, there's some nice shots when she's in the church later, and you get the little flickering candlelights and the little cross chandelier thing. But the beginning of this movie is just a car chase in the daylight, and he is in an Aston Martin with. A lady who we come to find out is some sort of psychological evaluation counselor person who is there to evaluate him. And they get into a car race with a Ferrari. And this is our introduction to Fomke's character on a top, although the name is not exactly spelled out at this point, because they're just flirty driving in a reckless and dangerous way that could theoretically kill not just themselves, but a bunch of bicyclists.
I mean, let's be honest. Who hasn't had a flirty race against a Ferrari down a curvy mountain road and almost killed don't know, 100 cyclists and run into a large work truck that's parked perpendicular on a mountain road for some reason.
Yeah, it is pretty silly. But
also, I do love the DB5, which is a great Aston Martin, and I feel like it was necessary for them to include that because I think this is also the first movie where James Bond decides to drive a BMW, which is, I don't know, borderline sacrilege.
Well, this is the first in a three-picture deal with BMW to promote the BMW car products. And the one in here is very small. According to Campbell, it's because this deal was worked out towards the end of production, so it's in here for like a couple minutes.
Yeah, he doesn't even really get to fire the missiles. He learns about the missiles behind the headlights, but they don't do anything.
Yeah, no, and he even tells Wade about the missiles. They spent more time talking about what this car could do than it doing anything other than driving.
Yeah, they gotta work that stuff in there. That's gotta be in there because that's Bondy. That's, you gotta have a car with bombs in it and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you know, flirtatious car chases. I think that's another one of the legally mandated Bond tropes.
Yeah, and what could be more inconspicuous on a dusty Cuban country road than a BMW C3? they sold a lot of the special edition Bond version of the Z3, apparently. But
did it just have like Pierce Brosnan's autograph on the dash or something?
I don't know. It probably had like a certificate of authenticity or something. As sad. They get rid of the DB5 because he goes into a casino in Monte Carlo, and on top is there. They have a weird thing about like license plates or something, or is that after? Anyway, they play a little game.
It's right after the card game.
Yeah, they play a little card game, kind of Casino Royale style. She is wearing some crazy top, and her hair is like perfectly immaculately set in a very severe fashion for having just been on a daring car chase. He wins, she loses. There's the thing with the drinks.
Well, she wins a couple of his lenticular baseball cards, and then they double down again. He gets a bunch of money from on credit, and then he wins all of her lenticular baseball cards back. And then she says a Russian curse word and smokes her gigantic cigar and runs away.
Yeah, and then they tap the mana, and that lets them put down a Leviathan, because that is an important part of this card game.
You're making a Dune reference or something?
Magic the Gathering, Dan.
Oh, I've never... Don't even come at me with Magic the Gathering. I don't know... I never sat at that lunch table in middle school where all the kids played their magic, so I don't know what that is.
You didn't have a deck?
Oh, hell no.
Well, anyway, there goes my card game joke.
Did you legitimately play Magic the Gathering?
Yeah, everybody played it.
No, not everybody. Don't try to brush this under the carpet as one of the many things that people of a generation did.
In the group that I associated with in middle school, there was the wave of Pogs, which I did not catch.
Because you didn't ride that wave of Pogs?
No, because by the time they got popular, they were like simultaneously banned from school because the teachers are like, you kids shouldn't be gambling with tiny pieces of cardboard, and then people getting upset and crying.
I mostly kept my Pogs at home because I was an only child and I was very possessive of my things and didn't want to lose them.
Yeah, and then after that, it was Magic the Gathering was the craze that swept Woodrow Wilson Middle School.
The craze that I went along with that followed the Pogs that got banned from the classrooms was yo-yos became a thing at our school for a little while.
Not so much for us, I don't think.
Yeah, but I had a really cool yo-yo. I don't remember where I got it. And then I kept bringing it with me. And then I saw other people bringing yo-yos. I'm not saying I started that trend, but I was in early on that one. I had a very low user number on the yo-yo forum. And then they all got banned.
Were you just doing dangerous tricks with your yo-yos? How did they get banned?
No, really what it was is you would see how long you get it to hang before you pull it back up.
Uh-huh.
I had a very I don't know, balanced and lubricated yo-yo that you could hang for a very long time.
A very well-endowed yo-yo, yes.
I had a very well-endowed yo-yo. And, you know, you just take it out in the middle of class, and suddenly you're in trouble.
Yeah. No. But yeah, anyway, it was Magic the Gathering was a big deal, and then everyone got bored with that and went on to Warhammer.
When did they go to the Yu-Gi-Ohs and the Pokemons?
That was after my time. Because I'm old.
I never played any card games.
Yes.
Ever.
Like, you mean collectible card games? Like, you've played Solitaire or Crazy Eights or something, or Uno.
I played some of those. I played Solitaire on computers. I played Uno. I've done an Uno or two.
I don't know why it sounds sad that you haven't played that often enough for it to be like just some normal thing. It had to be like a singular experience.
I've had an Uno, thank you.
What if we had a 007 movie where he's just playing Uno in Monte Carlo?
Where he's betting like 50 grand a hand, staring people down, and then drops down a reverse card.
Man, that would be so great.
Oh, God, I would love to hear Pierce Brosnan in his Bond voice say, "Go fish."
That's not what you do in Uno.
I know, but Go Fish is a game, too.
Yeah, it's just a different one. But
do you have any fours?
It would be entertaining, I think.
Do you have any 007s? Your cover's blown. Get out of there, man.
Well, he blows his own cover. Everywhere he goes, he's like, "I'm James Bond, British secret agent." It's like, okay, well, you know, that's not so great when you say it out loud like that. But
I work for MI6. Fight me.
he has the thing with On Top, and then there's mimes.
fancy Hollywood, or well, not Hollywood. Fancy Monte Carlo party.
Yeah.
You got expensive card games and mimes.
Yeah, on your rooftop stone amphitheater. We have two mimes with a rose. Which is so distracting to me because it has nothing to do with any, it's not symbolic of anything that's happening. It's just some weird mimes. But Pierce Brosnan quickly walks past them and up the amphitheater stairs to the top of the weird castle wall thing, and then looks out and sees where On Top has parked her car with the Canadian Admiral General guy. Then they go onto his yacht. And so he's observing all of this interesting information with his special binoculars that let him transmit the image he is seeing and change the zoom levels. So by the time he gets back to his car, his Aston Martin, he gets a printout.
A black and white dot matrix printout from his dash.
There was color for the photos, but it really looks so sad. It prints out, and there's a recorded message.
Nice tape deck in that thing too.
It sure does. I mean, only the best for James Bond. And the recorded message is from Moneypenny. It's not a phone call. She just explains the information about On Top and how he needs to stay on top of things. We got it. We got it. The James Bond, you know, innuendo pun name.
You get your funny names. You make a pun about it, but it's not James Bond making the pun about it yet. He even sort of like bites his tongue a little bit when he first learns her name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we see her get on top of something. There's some weird caustic lighting in the bedroom, which is curious because I don't think they had a pool inside of the bedroom. You see the rippling water effects as he's strangled to death by her thighs, which is something we had commented on when we were discussing the movie The Phantom, when he strangles two guys with his legs and shins.
I feel like Famke's a little better at it in this movie.
Yes. Well, it seems like she's actually exerting force, and it's not just sort of a slapsticky batting you around the neck kind of thing. But
she also relishes it a lot more. In the scene later where she does the same thing to James Bond, I was watching that, and Amanda was in the other room and yelled out and asked if I was watching porn. It's like, no, it's a James Bond movie, I swear.
No. Ms. On Top is just, you know, horny for murder. And she
is very horny for murder.
Yeah.
By fire, by a machine gun.
Yeah, when she's shooting up everybody with a machine gun, she's like, I don't know, panting? I don't know how to describe it. It's very strange.
Look, I know an automatic weapon can have the kind of recoil that can be potentially stimulating, but
You do. You know that.
I'm familiar with weapons.
You've played Uno twice, but you are very familiar with the stimulation of automatic weapons.
I've played Uno twice, and I've fired. No, I have never fired an AK-47, so I can't claim to have exact knowledge of what she was experiencing there.
Yeah. Well, she kills that guy, and then there's some stuff that's afoot with a frigate. The next morning, they steal a helicopter. Because
special helicopter with a big dome on the top.
Yes, the Eurocopter Tiger, which is apparently some collaboration between France and Great Britain, and it's hardened against electromagnetic stuff, and it is stealthy. Like, you can't detect where it goes afterwards, even though it's an enormous black helicopter. But
stealth helicopter is one thing, but can't be affected by EMP. I guess that's a Bond world invention that you just have to either buy into or you don't.
Yeah, well, I mean,
like missiles behind the headlights in a car.
Yeah, I guess you could, because they're basically like doing radiation shielding on this to shield it from radiation interference coming from outside of the vehicle.
Maybe it's like noise canceling headphones where like it detects an incoming EMP and it sets off an equal and opposite EMP in the other direction.
I'm really not sure that's how that works.
You don't know. You don't know how the Tiger worked.
You're right. I don't know how the Tiger worked. But that would have really screwed up Danny Ocean's plans. Now they take off with the helicopter. James Bond is tackled because he's just running on there like a person that you would tackle for security reasons. But
he figured out the plan, but he didn't figure it out with enough advanced time to be able to tell anyone about it. So he's literally just like running straight for a military demonstration of a new highly classified device. So obviously he's going to be tackled and probably, you know, shot.
Yeah,
if we're honest.
He had enough time to get off of the yacht he was on onto a smaller boat, then pilot that smaller boat over to the military dock near there, then run up there and past everybody to the gangplank, up the gangplank onto the boat, and not tell a single person what's
happening. This is why MI6 agents need badges, so he could just hold it up in the air and say, you know, Secret Service, secret agent coming through.
Oh, yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want to have a Secret Service agent badge thing for all circumstances where you could theoretically be captured? But he's captured, and we go to Severnaya. I can never say it.
Severnaya.
It is a miniature with snow, and there are dogs.
Yeah, so this is a top secret Russian space government base thing where they're doing hackery things. It's very War Games / NASA. Like, they've got the big control room there, and they're programming fake programs with fake computers and fake OSs that have Dennis Nedry graphics. Mm-hmm. And require cheeky, easy to guess passwords.
Don't forget. Completely made up computer stuff because you got to send a spike.
It's all complete nonsense. And you, not only is it nonsense contextually, just, you know, based on what the stuff is, it's nonsense because you watch like the way the text is revealed. You can see that it's like a bitmap mask wiping across. Like, it doesn't type letter by letter. Like, it draws pixel by pixel of each letter. So it's like, it's not a computer.
No, this is very silly. But it is silly in the way that all 90s computer stuff was, because you had writers who did not understand what was happening, so they'd make up their own kind of computery rules based on, I guess, skimming Wired. And then...
You got Alan Cumming. He's got some goofy glasses with tape on him. He twirls a pen. He's a nerd. He's got a funny catchphrase. He's a hacker.
And he commits sexual harassment in the workplace on a repeating basis.
Frequently, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, at least the coworkers sort of like roll their eyes and like call him a pig or whatever. But, you know, he's invincible, so you can't take him down.
Yeah. So he lets himself out for a smoke. And then a helicopter descends. We don't see any more of Alan Cumming for a while. So we don't know if he died or what, but I would just posit that most people would probably suspect that he was not killed. In walks Orimov and Famke, and they enter the facility because he has access. He's in charge of things, so why wouldn't you let him in? And that this is where stuff starts to not go so well. Meanwhile, back in England, James is debriefing about the helicopter and stuff, and the emergency signal from the facility comes in because Famke shot up everybody in a horny rage, and the only one who survived is our protagonist for this one and only film, Natalia Simonova, Natalia Simonova, who is the only survivor of this. She hides in the office break room, and Famke
switcheroo. She tries to hide in the ceiling, like a good diehard person would, but she can't get up there, so she hides under the sink.
Yes, it was a good fake out. It worked really well. But she was noticed because she knocked over something, which is a pattern for her because she does that again in the library later. But
she's just, you know, she's just a nerdy computer hacker who's a klutz.
Mm-hmm. And they set off GoldenEye, which has a funny little laser beam that shoots through a plastic crystal and changes the screen so that the satellite in orbit alters course to destroy the facility that they are in. And this is interesting because we see the miniature of some casing come off of the satellite, and these little like wing things expand with pods, and it's very missile shaped. And then
it ejects from its protective Amazon package that it was shipped there in. And it extends its wings so it could properly navigate through the space wind.
Yes, because they don't seem to be used for power, but
it's I thought it had like some solar looking panels on or something, but it's a good plan because they stole their EMP helicopter, and even though the jets got deployed, they stole the GoldenEye weapon. They destroyed all of the evidence of the GoldenEye weapon because they blasted the headquarters where it was stored and took out all of the jets and stuff. And luckily MI6 happens to be on it, so they kind of like watch it, and they're already talking about and theorizing what this base was for, and they're like, oh, we thought it was for a GoldenEye, but we determined they don't have the money for a GoldenEye, so it can't be for a GoldenEye. And then the GoldenEye goes off, and James Bond's like, oh yeah, looks like they have money for a GoldenEye. But anyway, that scene's interesting because it's the first time apparently we get to see Judi Dench's M, and there's some tension. They're being very not passive aggressive, they're being British aggressive at each other.
Yes. I really genuinely like Judi Dench. She delivers a fantastic role here. The tone for this is perfect because she's the new boss who is not well liked. She's taking over for a boss that was liked. And she is also a woman in a position of authority who has to balance being liked with getting stuff done and having the respect of the people who work for her, because that is a thing.
She's a numbers gal. She's an accountant, apparently.
Yes. You think, but I'm a bean counter.
Yeah, you think I'm a bean counter, but you know what? I think you're a sexist, misogynist
dinosaur.
Dinosaur, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is like, boom, nailed him. That's literally exactly what he is. And then he just kind of chuckles and he's like, fair point. She's like, no, not fair point. Listen to me, jerk.
But I do like the scene where they sit in her office and he's like, you know, your predecessor had a bottle of cognac. She's like, we're having bourbon. And then she pours...
Notice Judi Dench did not say, I prefer American bourbon.
No, God, that would be awful.
It's like the Genghis Khan from Shadow.
Yeah, it is interesting that she would like bourbon, but she does pour the exotic bourbon beverage. And they sip on that while...
She asks James Bond if he wants ice, and he says yes, and then she pours two neat glasses of bourbon, and then the sound designers add ice sounds.
It's weird, because there's a part of me that's like, she had said that on set, so like... They must have known that they needed to have some there. Maybe we just couldn't see it because the refraction of the glass was so strong, or the crystal.
No, but like when he tilts up his drink to drink it, you can see there's nothing in that glass other than just their fake alcohol.
But it's so weird, because why would you have that line of dialogue?
Plus, you're over the shoulder of Brosnan when he says yes, so you could easily have just, like, ADR'd that to be a no thank you.
You could have cut around the whole thing, so I don't know what the point was, but they have their little moment.
Why cut around it when you can ADR and make it more complicated, Joe?
Yeah, they have their little moment where she's like, you know, go, you know, find this survivor of this thing, and, you know, don't, like, blow up things or have sex with people, and he's like, okay, great. And so
try not to be you.
Yeah. And he flies off to Moscow, where he meets Wade. We are introduced to Wade, who is played by veteran character actor Jovan Baker. He's a CIA officer who is very American in a caricature kind of way, but somehow appropriate for this. And
I'm fat and dumb, and I don't like using spycraft code words to let you know that I'm the right person and not somebody who's going to kidnap you.
Yeah, but he's competent at his job. He does say that his vehicle runs great and he never has a problem with it, and then it immediately breaks down, which is, I guess, for comedy, but not played for laughs.
I mean, but he can fix it with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, and just chiseling the motor. They get that up and running, and he says that what he should do for trying to meet this Janos guy, who's part of the syndicate thing, who Onatopp is in, is that he should get to his main competitor, who is Robbie Coltrane as Valentin Dmitrievich Zhukovsky, who comes back in later films. But in this... he is a Russian mafia mob boss guy. Not your, like, Eastern Promises kind of way, but, like, in a very cartoony, funny kind of way.
He's not naked, covered in tattoos in a steam room.
No, I don't think I really would enjoy that. But he gets dropped off there at the thing. He goes inside. He threatens Valentin with his life, because apparently he's the one who gave Valentin his limp. This is a sore point between them, and
it's a pretty standard, boring sort of like spy meets guy he has history with scene, and this is one scene where they take the opportunity to add some comedy in, you know, him shooting like in between his legs into the chair, and then of course with his mistress Minnie Driver singing a very terrible rendition of oh god, what song is she singing?
I don't know. It was like, stand by your
man. Oh, yeah. She's singing a tone-deaf, Russian-accented version of Stand By Your Man while wearing a cowboy hat. I do love when he asks who's strangling a cat, and Robbie Coltrane does his Russian accent, strangling a cat, and then turns around and sees her, and then just immediately shoots in between his legs, saying, hey, man, that's my mistress. And then he tells her to take a hike.
Yeah.
It's a good scene with some comedy, and they, you know, they have their male spy bravado nonsense for a little bit, and then they both go have a drink, and he's like, yeah, man, you know, this Giannis guy is bad news. He's been through some stuff, whole Cossack backstory thing about wanting revenge, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't remember, does he give him anything other than that information? Does he send him away anywhere in particular?
Well, they make that arrangement that his man will go get this thing and do the whatever.
He's going to help him out by, like, rigging an exchange where his guy won't get arrested with the money and the other guy will get arrested with whatever the merchandise was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, you know, again, I appreciate that they tied up all of the plot elements so that it all kind of makes sense. And he's actually going from place to place in this plot line for reasons, rather than just like James Bond meandering through towns the way Daniel Craig kind of does, and sort of like sits at a bar and then somebody comes and attacks him, and then there's a 10-minute action scene, and then he kills somebody, and then he gets yelled at for killing somebody, and then he gets told to fly to a different part of the country because somebody else had a lead there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's refreshing when story's connected.
Yeah.
But
police work.
Natalia has found her way to St. Petersburg. I misspoke earlier. I said Moscow. They're in St. Petersburg. Not the Florida kind. But the...
Can you imagine if this all took place in Florida?
It would be so funny.
Oh, everybody, they would be in their Cuban outfits the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess that wouldn't be so funny, because then we'd just get more of that part of the movie we didn't like. But, so, she arrives, and then she goes to a computer retailer, a reseller of IBM products, fine IBM computers, and she gives off a list of machines that she would like, with 500 megabyte hard drives and CD-ROM drives and 14.4 modems.
They are, after all, international business machines. But yeah, she's mm-hmm. she's pretending to be a buyer so she can, you know, test out a fancy computer, so she can hack the mainframe and communicate with Boris to see if he's still around. And she communicates with him, and Boris is like, "Oh my God, you're still alive. Be very careful. Don't trust anyone. Meet me at this church in an hour." And then she goes, and Boris is like, "Haha, I betrayed you and got you now."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty boring. I do like the way they frame the shot of Boris trying to calm her down and saying everything's fine, and then Thomka is right behind him coming into frame. It's a nice touch. But things go in directions poorly for whatever reasons that we don't need to care about. But Pierce Brosnan winds up running into 006 at the thing with the statues and stuff.
Mm-hmm. He didn't die in the beginning scene. He turns out to be the head of the crime group. He's Giannis, and everyone is acting on his behest because he wants his revenge. So he stole the Goldeneye. He's going to use it against England. Well, I mean, you know, it's jumping ahead a little bit, but basically he's going to steal everybody's money and then, you know, erase the debt record.
Yeah.
So he's Tyler Durden.
The James Bond pompous version of that. This is weird because James Bond hasn't been disarmed, and so he finally raises up his handgun to shoot him, but then he's hit with a tranquilizer dart.
Right in the neck.
Yeah. And
it's a good shot too. I mean, I appreciate the 006. It's like, come on, man, I've anticipated all your moves because, you know, I'm six and you're seven, and I know your moves, so chill.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, you're probably gonna, but I'm still gonna try and point this gun at you.
But it's silly because, again, we get into that classic James Bond villain trope of not just killing James Bond when you have him. And so they drop him into the expensive helicopter they stole because they apparently have no more need of it. And they are going to send it. They're going to activate the missiles to shoot itself, blowing it up along with them. So that I guess they will be framed for the, theft of the Goldeneye device from the facility, because she is a programmer from there and he is a British secret agent. So obviously that would cause some tension. But
I buy the motivation to frame them for the stealing the helicopter and stuff, because that, you know, borderline works when you're talking to French defense minister shortly hereafter. But they probably should have like hung out to see like if it actually worked or not. And maybe disabled the eject button or something.
Yeah, or...
because it just turns into Die Hard 2.
Or they could have killed them and then just put them in the helicopter.
Well, then, they would have seen that they got shot in the head and also blew up.
They could have just poisoned them. They had tranquilizer technology. Just shoot them up with more tranquilizer. Also, they're going to blow the crap out of it with two missiles.
Yeah, I mean, but that could have just been like, whoopsie-daisy, we leaned on the wrong button.
Well, I mean, if you're going to hope that these people are framed for the crime that you committed, you kind of want them to be identifiable and not just like scattered teeth all over the place, because it's hard for dental records. But anyway, They'll
compare his teeth to his Walther PPK, and then they'll be like, oh, this is probably James Bond.
Only three people have teeth like this with Walther PPK. But
I've brushed two of them.
License to floss.
Like, people buy guns all the time. Like,
yeah,
I don't think there's like a limit to the number of people that can carry a Walther PPK. Also, you know, if they were going to revamp something, like have him drive a BMW instead of an Aston Martin, like why couldn't they give him a different gun? Like, I don't think it has to be a Walther PPK to be a James Bond movie, because it's a stupid gun.
I mean, I don't have any any understanding of what would be appropriate for the situation. So
it's tiny and stupid and is not intimidating.
Okay. Well, I mean, he's a secret agent, Dan. He's not an obvious agent. I mean, he's obvious, but I mean, you get what I'm saying here.
Do I?
Yeah, of course you do. Because I'm clear and concise. But they get out of there, but they're arrested, and they're hauled off to a castle dungeon in St. Petersburg, where they're thrown into a room. The defense minister goes in there with one guard for two people. They briefly had exchanged names before the defense minister comes in, and she refused to tell him anything. So obviously she's not trying to, like, give up on her people or whatever. But then the defense minister says what they're accused of, and she says, no, this is the thing. And this is when Orimov comes in, and he's very upset that
he tried to resign earlier when he thought, oh no, I'm a failure, and one of the, you know, everybody got blowed up and there was one person who escaped, and then the guy's like, no, there were two people that escaped. He's like, you know what? I'm going to do some investigation. I guess I won't resign just yet. And now he's like, how dare you investigate this? This is my investigation, because I am very invested in this investigation.
Yes, yes. As you can tell by my total surprise that this is occurring. He does a very good job faking out everybody that he's not going to shoot them. But he...
He picks up the gun very quickly and says, look at this gun. I have seen this before. Mm-hmm. And then the guy's like, can you put that down, please?
Yeah.
And he doesn't. He shoots everybody with it.
Yeah. And there are no guards in the immediate vicinity, because there was just that one guy for some reason. But then he starts shouting for guards to come, but doesn't kill them. I don't know.
Well, you know, they flip the table and they hide, so, yeah. You know.
And then they go through the archives, and there's a nice set piece of knocking over books like bookcases like dominoes, and then there's people down on the first floor shooting up, although it doesn't make any sense why no one was hit, because they are spraying bullets everywhere. And then she falls through a hole in the floor and is captured by Orimov. And he makes a clever escape out a window with his belt, and he commandeers a tank while they're going to his car with his police escort. He pursues them with a tank through St. Petersburg, or at least a reasonable facsimile of the streets thereof, and runs over lots of stuff and causes havoc. It's
a very good action scene.
It's a very good action scene. And this is where we get the bombastic full orchestra version of the James Bond score that you would expect. And that's because this is replacing an earlier music cue by Eric Serra that was not used. You can hear it on the soundtrack. You can just fire that puppy up and go to the St. Petersburg music cue, and you will hear that, and it is a huge difference versus what's in the film.
It is an abomination.
It is real bad.
It is some like proto Swordfish garbage.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I would have rather had Paul Oakenfold score this whole movie than this. But
everyone would have to be wearing like bright orange leather jackets and Oakley sunglasses.
Would be an interesting take on James Bond, but. I mean, Moby does collaborate on the next one. Remember the Moby version of the James Bond theme?
No. I remember that one Moby song that's in the end credits of all 11 Bourne movies or whatever there are.
Yeah. Bourne. But
Born to be Wild.
And there's the tank chase, lots of stuff, dramatic statue stuff on top of the tank. It's really good stuff. People getting knocked off of stuff, crushed, cars exploding. There's stuff with this tank, like, I believe loosely bumps into things and they just explode. So the timing of the pyrotechnics is a little questionable, but he loses them when they get to the train yard, but he somehow can get ahead of their train and cut them off at the tunnel.
I see some getting on the, you know, the comically designed stealth train.
Yeah, but I don't know how he got down the track to, because it was like miles away, because they actually start the train and get it going up at full speed before he rendezvous with them, and it's a tank.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they had to, you know, store everyone's luggage, check their tickets, you know, take their pre-trip beverage orders.
Mm-hmm. And we all know there's only one track that goes out of a train yard, so there's no other possible direction they could have taken. They would have definitely gone through the tunnel. But he cuts them off of the pass, and for some reason, Natalia's still alive, and Sean Bean is doing this weird, super gross thing of, you know, anything that he has, I can have, blah, blah, blah. And there's some sort of weird, like, I don't know, innuendo that they shared partners on occasion, which is unsettling, just in a weird kind of way. But
he's just becoming the gross rapey Bond villain that he was meant to be.
Yeah, and he does the whole like licking thing, which is nobody should lick. So that's
there should be no non-consensual licking of people's faces.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I believe that is like movie shorthand for this is a bad person, but it feels kind of lazy whenever you see it. It's very cliche.
Yeah, because Terminator 2, there's another one of those guys. Mm-hmm. He gets jacked up. Mm-hmm. He's a bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are other traits about being good or bad or so subtle that you definitely need the licking in order to be able to discern that they are indeed bad people. But he gives the order.
You know, it's just a really simple screen rule for the audience. If you see a lick, you know, they're a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to come up with something that rhymed, like a mnemonic or something, but it didn't really work.
If you see a lick, he must be a bleep.
Yeah, if you see a lick, he's a prick.
Oh, is that non-censorable? Okay.
Yeah, but, yeah, I almost, yeah.
I'll consult our style guide, but the engineer guy says he sees the thing on the track, and he's like, no, ramming speed.
Which, I don't know, what is the lever on a train that says ramming speed? You think it's just like low, medium, high ramming speed?
I don't know, because it doesn't really seem to, like, they're not don't seem to be going appreciably faster than before. They just seem to be not be braking. But the tank fires some big old shell at the front of it, and so you get a flaming face train, and it crashes into the tank, but it derails the train, which is what the engineer had said would happen, because obviously
the tank explodes into a lot of little Lego pieces.
Mm-hmm. And then Bond gets onto the train while everybody is knocked out. Orimov and Natalia are in one train car, and Fomka and Sean Bean are in the other. He's got the gun, so he's got the upper hand, except he lets them stand up so that Sean Bean can use a walkie-talkie to summon Orimov in to threaten Natalia's life. Again, this is the part of the movie where you could just shoot people, but he doesn't. And they get away with his super secret automatically lock the trade door button on the other side of the door, I guess, because threats.
You know, it's a rolling panic room. It's a panic train.
Yeah, I mean, well, threats can come from any angle. That's why you want to be able to lock someone inside of a train car. That was your headquarters, but they do, and. This is where Sean Bean says that he's going to give James the same 6 minutes that he gave him. And James says, what is the, you know, that means we got 3 minutes, and it's like, uh-oh. And meanwhile, you might be thinking, why not just make it no minutes? Why not just blow them up? But that's
he's got to get to a safe distance himself.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. But it doesn't seem like you need to be that far away from the train, turns out, because he laser cuts through the floor with his Omega watch, and then she uses the computer to spike Boris, and she finds that he's in Cuba right before he pulls all the motherboards out of the server rack to disconnect the internet.
You know, because his trace program, it jams the other person's phone line so they can't hang up, so you can track them.
Yes.
But, you know, that's software hack. You got to go to the hardware level. So you just start yanking, exploding and sparking motherboards out of a server to prevent the hack, because that is how you hang up a phone.
No.
I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, he could have just like unplugged the cable out of the, you know, the NIC card or whatever, but like, it's fine.
Yeah, there's so much stuff in this movie where it's just like, oh no, this thing's gonna break, and then it explodes, and you're like, was that just made of gunpowder? Like, what was going on?
Everything in this movie is made out of, it's all like, I assume that like pink-ish fluid that is dripping out of everything is supposed to be gas. It's either made out of gunpowder or gasoline or sparks.
Yeah. But they're out of there now, and she says that he needs to take her with her the flight that they're going to go on to go to Cuba, because she knows how to disarm the thing. And so they do. And they meet Wade again, who has a plane, and he gets the Z3, and they get the plane. And then they go sulk at the beach, stuff. And we see the, weird, Westin Marriott, whatever lobby that was turned into an evil command center. it is not my favorite Bond villain lair. That's for sure. But, there's just computers everywhere and people going around. It has some height to it. There are several stories of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's
kind of like the Terminator 3 Skynet spoiler alert command center at the end.
Yeah.
Except, you know, a 90s version instead of the 70s version or whatever it was.
And not as infuriating, I suppose. But they use the GoldenEye thing to redirect the satellite. They're up in the Bond and Natalia are up in the air, scoping
also
out the joint.
Conveniently repositioning this satellite also takes 6 minutes. Apparently, everything in this universe takes 6 minutes.
It's a theme.
Yeah.
Because it's the 006.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. 006, 6 minutes on the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
6 minutes to move the satellite.
Mm-hmm.
Were there other sixes that we missed?
No, I think that was just it. Oh, wait, was there a six when she flips the card in the casino?
Oh, I'm sure there was.
Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Maybe the mime is holding a rose with six petals, but
probably. But like, who could tell what the dealer just kept saying, like, bum diddle bum bum bum. I can't tell what the hell he was saying.
Yeah. Well,
I
didn't realize a timpani had been inducted into this film as a dealer,
as a car dealer. Yeah.
But
a vest on it. No, this guy didn't have a vest on. I'm thinking of the Casino Royale guy.
Yeah, so they are going to fire up the dishy thing, and not before they shoot the plane with the missile that causes it to crash, and they send out Famke in a helicopter where she rappels down as the only person to do battle with Bond and with Natalia. And
you know, the movie felt so good up until it went off the rails in Cuba and became sort of the proto version of what the rest of the Bond movies were going to be, where it's a little less serious, a little more far-fetched and just kind of like cheesy. I mean, this is why I'll always be alone. And then like they have like a hate makeout session that was very bad and should have been cut. But then here you get to the point where it's like, oh no, we got shot down and I dragged her from the fiery wreckage of the plane. And, it was so traumatic that I have to lay on the ground and like pass out or faint or something. And I see the helicopter coming in. Now I'm immediately going to wake up and fight the woman who's trying to kill me with her thighs again. So it starts to get a little silly and less grounded in just the way people would do things, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's the whole thing with the helicopter, and then she gets pulled up in the tree and then killed, and then he says, oh, she always liked a good squeeze. And it's like,
I do like the way he took care of her. Although, you know, like, if you're going to rappel off of a helicopter, like, you know, rappelling 101 is like disconnect when you hit the ground. Mm-hmm. So whatever. But I like that he, you know, shot at the helicopter and made it swerve away and, you know, killed her that way. Yeah. That was good.
Yeah. Well, I just think that moment of levity was weird. But the dish is drained, and they find out that the dish was there all along. It was just hidden underneath a reservoir of water, and the dish is just the Arecibo array that you've seen in other films and photography from other places. Naturally, they did not have the budget to just build one. But
although I feel like some of those close-up shots where the water is draining, they built a very small version of it.
Oh, yes, they built a tiny one. But there's
a lot of reverse footage in there, too. You notice, I mean, it's very easy to see when the water is flowing backwards.
It's so frustrating, too, when it gets down to the very bottom and they're, like, really concentrating on the slow-down reverse animation, which is even worse because then you're just, like, watching these waves lap up backwards into the air and then back down again.
Somebody was just like, look how cool it looks that it's like sucking the water down into this little area. It's like, no, it looks backwards.
Yeah, it really genuinely looks like it's going in reverse. But they, you know, start walking around the perimeter of this thing because they're going to go up to the antenna and mess it up. But then guards come out and they start shooting at them. So they jump off and then slide down to an access way that takes them immediately to the like nerve center of this entire operation, which is an interesting place to put that. But they start laying charges and shooting people, and they unfortunately get into a situation where there's capturing that ensues, but not before Natalia sets off a thing to encrypt, which has its own special user interface where it says encryption in progress and blinks on the screen. She encrypts the guidance system and is then captured and brought before 006 again. And
so what did she do? Did she just like install File Vault or something on the satellite? I don't know what she did there. I guess it's not really relevant.
Well, she supposedly changed the guidance system so that it would burn up over the Atlantic, and then encrypted.
Sure. No, that was very useful.
Yeah, and then encrypted the controls. I don't know how one does this, but she password protected the ability to control it. And it crashes, falls down. Well, it starts to descend into the upper atmosphere, which is a blue glowing blob. But but then down in the command center, Boris, you know, says a bunch of dumb stuff, and then she decks him. And this is funny because he gets his pen mixed up with 007's pen, which is a grenade that you click three times and then you can disarm it, or it blows up on a 3-second trigger, or 4-second trigger. And you get these reaction shots going back and forth between Pierce Brosnan and the clicky pen and Alan Cumming's face as he's typing one-handed to try and disable the encryption. Finally, he identifies the correct pattern and knocks the pen out of Alan Cumming's hands, which causes it to explode and ignite all the pink liquid we saw dripping out that no one seemed to care about, and that blows up a lot of stuff. And you get a lot of shots from, I guess, second unit photography where they were just blowing up workstations left and right. It had seemingly nothing to do with where the gasoline had been inside of the facility.
You know, everything's made out of gunpowder, so a little spark lands here or there, so it's got to explode.
Yeah, yeah. It just doesn't. This whole place just seems like an OSHA violation. But they,
I mean, it's underneath a lake. Like you're bound to have problems. Maybe that, you know, they should have just, if there was still water in the dish, they could have just like opened like a little valve and like flooded the whole room and like put out the fire.
I feel like they would have other problems if they did that, Dan.
Yeah, but you know, they could swim out for a little while, and then, you know, there's probably a bilge pump or something that they could, you know, get all the water back out.
Yeah, I would just never control the satellite again.
Well.
But
this is before they invented Halon, isn't it? No, when was Terminator 2?
Well, that was liquid nitrogen. And there's liquid nitrogen here, too.
No, there's the computer system at Cyberdyne was protected by Halon. That's why they had to wear the gas masks.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. No,
I thought you're effective at putting out fires, but also not destroying technology.
I thought you were talking about the scene where someone is frozen, but
no, we haven't gotten to that part yet.
Yeah. So they Bond and Natalia go up the elevator to access the antenna so they can break it in case Boris breaks the encryption and redirects the antenna. So Boris is working. Sean Bean tells a guard to watch him, and if he moves, kill him, which is pretty good motivation. And Sean Bean goes up to personally chase after James Bond, which seems like the kind of thing that you should really delegate, because there's only one of you, and there's at least two of them.
Well, he's delegated it a couple times, and his guards have been thwarted because they are not up to the level of competency required to kill a 00.
No, well, see, the dumb thing is, they could have, they genuinely could have killed him, but the problem was Sean Bean himself said, go get them, go capture them, bring them over here, all this other stuff, and it's like, you should really just tell them to murder James Bond.
Yeah, but part of his, I mean, what's the advantage of being the richest person in the world if you can't, like, use that money and flaunt it? And he does want to torture James.
Yeah,
but he didn't even get a chance yet to like strap him on a big metal table with a laser pointer at his junk. So he's got plans.
Yeah, but at a certain point, you got to be like, you know what? What's the really important thing I'm trying to accomplish here? Is it torturing James Bond, or is it my plan not completely failing?
Yeah,
and no. He doesn't make the right call in that department because he goes up there and gets very consumed by fighting James. In the antenna control area, fighting him to the death. But he doesn't seem super concerned at all about the antenna, which Alan Cumming gets back online, but Pierce Brosnan puts a stick in the like giant bike gear that controls the antenna.
Yeah. And that jams it, and then apparently this machinery is so old and dumb it doesn't have any sort of like fail safe to stop, so it just keeps like cranking on itself until it explodes.
Yes, which I like, because again, what blew up, was it like the lubricant that was keeping these cogs going? Did that
ignite?
Oh, sure.
You know, bike chain oil is very flammable.
Yes, but Sean Bean and Pierce Brosnan, they're fighting all up and down and throughout this whole antenna thing before they finally dangle off the little bottom part of the thing on an emergency ladder, and Sean Bean's going to very slowly kill him now. Again, not being concerned at all about the actual problems that he has.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he runs out of bullets, so he has to climb down and kick him off the ladder or whatever. But
he does it slow, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's dangling off the bottom of Cloud City and he wants to, you know, drop him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But turns out the dropper becomes the droppee, and then he slips, and then James grabs him by the foot and he's like, I got you, even though I hate you, and you're trying to do bad things, I got you, buddy. And then Sean Bean's like, you know, for England, James, which is his thing from the beginning of the movie. He's like, nah, bro, I'm going to kill you for me, and then he drops him.
Yeah.
Which apparently doesn't kill him. He falls, like, you know, 300 feet onto a metal satellite dish, but it really just, like, messes him up real bad. But he's still alive down there.
It's really strange. I think I would have felt better about this had it been very directly related to his survival, as opposed to we are out of the immediate danger, so I could theoretically rescue you and allow you to live. But I won't. So it makes it seem like a more purposeful murder. But, you know, on second thought, I it's probably better that they went with a purposeful murder, because then I would just have dinged it if they went with a convenient way for the bad guy to die without having to deal with the complex moral issues. But
yeah, I mean, also, yeah. Like,
he does have a license to kill, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, what did we really expect was going to happen? Like, I mean, even if he, like, pulled him up, like, what were they going to do? Were they going to, like, casually climb out of there together?
Yeah, well, I mean, they were going to, like, you know, arrest him, I suppose. But they...
But, like, how is he going to get him off of the satellite? But, you know, he's he deserves it. He killed lots of people. He's a bad guy.
I don't feel sorry for him. It's just a weird, like, thing to do to James.
Most of his murder in this movie is very justified and is not really dancing the moral boundary that this is one of the things they played with a lot more in the Daniel Craig James Bond. But he's been doing his best to defend himself and blow up lots of, you know, faceless soldiers and guards or whatever in matching suits that don't really have personalities.
Well, I mean, I would say that the one unfortunate thing is the Russian soldiers theoretically aren't his enemy. It's just because of the circumstance that they got into that they're, you know, going to kill him. Because
well, this is not part of the you know, the Russian military per se. Like the whole Giannis like crime thing is like he's a mob guy kind of.
No, but I'm talking about earlier when they were in St. Petersburg.
Oh, sure.
Like he's just killing like people left and right that could have been just fine upstanding people, and he's murdering them.
Yeah, it's self-preservation, and then he gets a tank. So he's just having like baby's day out in St. Petersburg or whatever. He's like, I got a tank, like screw it, man.
But this Natalia had put a gun to a helicopter pilot's head so that they would go up and save him. Instead, he gets on the thing. They fly out of there as the whole thing explodes like the freaking Death Star.
then falls down on wounded Sean Bean below.
Yeah, and they drop off.
Killing him?
Well, because you got to make sure that he got exactly what he deserved, which is apparently dropping 300 feet and then having an antenna fall on you. Alan Cumming dies from liquid nitrogen, which is apparently stored on the other side of the building from the gasoline.
You got your gas tanks, you got your liquid nitrogen tanks, and then the computer's in the middle.
Yeah.
What could go wrong?
That's
how you know it's an evil lair.
doesn't really seem like this was very well planned.
Probably cyanide tanks in there, too.
Yeah, we get the horrible frozen Alan Cumming after he says he's invincible. It's a nice laugh line, but...
I kind of was expecting him to, like, shatter. I didn't remember if he did or not, or explode. You know, I wanted him to explode because literally everything else in the movie exploded. So yeah. He's just kind of, like, hanging there, frozen. It's like, go on, explode, yeah. Do it.
I feel unfulfilled by Alan Cumming not exploding. But the... maybe I should have phrased that differently. But anyway, they land the helicopter. Well, not land, but the helicopter pilot drops them off, and they're like, goodbye, helicopter pilot. Thank you for just dropping us in this field. And then they start making out on the ground, and then Wade is there, and Pierce Brosnan's like, I thought you were going to bring backup. And then all the Marines pop up, and they had been sitting there watching them smooch. And they're going to go fly back to Guantanamo, because obviously the U.S. doesn't really have the jurisdiction to operate in Cuba like this. But when has that stopped the U.S.? So they hop on the helicopters and ride off into the sunset.
Yep. We
never see Natalia ever again.
You know, the third act, the whole Cuba bit, is a little underwhelming for me, but the rest of this movie is... very real, very solid, and I like all of it.
Yep, I generally agree with you. There are parts that work in the Cuba stuff, but there are just enormous logic plot holes in here where you're just like, so why aren't you just murdering him right now? But
then you got the really lackluster base. Like, you could kind of forgive Severnaya for being like tacky and weird looking because it's like, you know, Soviet era Russian junk from previous decades, but it just becomes campy and weird.
Well,
as soon as he takes that suit off and goes to Cuba, like, it's all downhill.
I like this Severnaya, the production design of that, because it looked like a military base and it looked like something that had been constructed in the late 70s or 80s, because it had a very like brutalist design to everything. The enormous eye that opens up that has your your security chip thing to use for the GoldenEye trigger. Mm-hmm. Like it had a good production design aspect to that. There was just no flare in the interior of the layer. I like that it was a giant dish thing. That was interesting. But this isn't even the first, like, I have a thing that is hidden by a lake thing, because if you go back to, like, You Only Live Twice, a problematic Sean Connery James Bond film, and to be specific about the ways in which it is problematic, it is mainly in concern to culture and race, but also sexism. But that's... It's neither here nor there.
I feel like the entire James Bond franchise could just be, and also sexism.
I want to see a series that is just exploring the HR part of this. Like, you know how they release like promotional webisodes and stuff? Like, just have a promotional webisode where it's just somebody who's like filing all the paperwork to deal with everything that's happened in a James Bond
film. It would
just
be 20 hours of somebody like writing on a piece of paper at their desk and occasionally whispering, oh, that's not right.
Yeah. He's just interviewing people and it'd be like, so then you did what? he did what to you? No, that would be pretty good. And be like, how many fingers did you lose? But that would be a pretty funny webisode to do.
He put how many diamonds in your belly button?
So silly. But they conclude this one. It's a successful outing. It was a huge financial success. It kicked off a new era in James Bond that fizzled slowly over like the next decade.
I know you said you enjoy whatever the Tomorrow Never Dies or whatever, but I think it fizzled pretty damn quickly.
I really think you are underestimating the degree of drop between Tomorrow Never Dies and The World Is Not Enough.
Is The World Is Not Enough, is that the diamond one?
No.
Oh, right. It's Christmas Jones.
Yes. Nuclear scientist Christmas Jones.
Bad one.
And the nuclear sub. Yeah.
Remember Denise Richards?
Yeah.
My problem is, of course, Tomorrow Never Dies is just, it's when the plot goes completely off the rails and there's like, we don't need to make a lick of sense anymore. We're just going to have stealth boats and giant three-bladed drill things that attack ships and stuff. Like, it's very stupid. And I understand the realism associated with, you know, the media controlling things and being very dangerous or whatever, but Jonathan Pryce is not intimidating.
Well, he was the Infinity guy. What's not intimidating about that? He was in Brazil.
I haven't seen Brazil. The Infinity guy.
You should. You remember he was the spokesman for Infinity in the 90s?
No, isn't he on the Games of Thrones?
Well, he was later.
Spoiler, jeez. No, I just picture, like, if he were an actual bad guy, James Bond would just walk up to him and, like, punch him in the larynx and he would die.
But I don't know. I don't want to litigate that movie right now because we've had such a good experience with this. Let's not ruin it. And we should both rewatch that and come with a fresh perspective and discuss it then.
Actually, I will say there is one thing about Tomorrow Never Dies that I remember incredibly vividly, and I will never forget, and I thoroughly love it. And it is a part when they're on the secret boat, and Michelle, I forgot her last name. Yes, she is like trying to sabotage a computer, so she takes a machine gun and shoots the computer, and it makes the sound of breaking pottery. The sound effects guy's like, I don't know where the like exploding glass sound is, so I'm just going to take the I dropped a pot sound and put that in here.
Foley work
gets me every time. Yeah. Anyway, this GoldenEye is a very good movie. Mm-hmm. It's I have a bias because it's a 90s movie, and you know only 90s kids will remember Pierce Brosnan, but it is my favorite Bond movie, I think. I mean, I like a lot of the Daniel Craig stuff, but like when you factor in some of the nostalgia and just, you know, the era of it, I really like this movie.
Yep. Agreed. I like this one. Don't like the music, as we discussed. And that is one thing
that
I definitely... Yeah, it was one thing that no matter what your feelings about the plot or silliness or anything that's going on in the other movies, at least you have David Arnold scoring those, and he does a much better job. But we will continue with more of this at a later time. Until that point, let's ride off into the sunset.
On a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.